So, Professor Robert Innes, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about your work in the Lancet Neurology. Perhaps we could kick off by you telling us a little bit about the measurement of neuroinflammation and what it can tell us about neurological and psychiatric disorders.
What the imaging can tell us is going to be different for psychiatry and neurology because it reflects the state of development of the two different fields. Roughly speaking, I would say that in psychiatry, the question is, does neuroinflammation exist? In neurology, the question is, do our tools measure the known neuroinflammation there? Neurology is far more advanced in understanding, let's say, types of dementia that exist. There's a known neuropathology, there are multiple subtypes. So there's Alzheimer's disease and frontotemporal dementia, and then subtypes of frontotemporal dementia. We have nothing like that in psychiatry. The comparable disorder might be, or comparative disorder could be depression or major depressive disorder. In neurology, we can say Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, plural. In psychiatry, it's only singular, major depressive disorder, but it is surely a very heterogeneous disorder, and a subset of such patients may have neuroinflammation. So I followed the route that used the disorders that are well identified, have a known neuropathology, and have inflammation in them, and see whether our tools of measuring inflammation with PET can detect the known existence, and it did. It can then answer advanced questions like how much inflammation, does the inflammation correlate with disease severity, and does it correlate with disease progression? In psychiatry, it's, well, having validated the tool to know that it works in the brain where there's inflammation, can we see it at all, for example, in major depressive disorder?
Looking a bit more in depth at your work, what makes PET imaging suited for these purposes compared with other approaches?
So the PET, or just commonly called PET imaging, positron emission tomography, has, by physical and chemical properties, unusually high sensitivity and specificity. Sensitivity and specificity. By that I mean that it can detect proteins in the brain that are present at very, very low concentrations, maybe 10 to the minus 12th molar. Whereas MRI imaging, the most that it can measure in terms of sensitivity, its target, whatever it's measuring, might be 10 to the minus fourth molar. We're talking about eight orders of magnitude greater sensitivity. And then in addition to that, it has specificity or selectivity, so it can measure a selected protein in the brain. So if you think protein X is involved with that disorder, it's present at 10 to the minus ninth molar, you can measure that low density protein specifically with PET, and it's not possible with MRI. So one advantage is its unusual high sensitivity and specificity. And another is that it is a direct measurement in the brain. So we're looking directly in the brain itself, and we're able to do so without cracking open the skull and that level of invasiveness. Without doing that, we're left with looking in the periphery, maybe in plasma or in urine. And that can be an inadequate or inaccurate measure, or not a measure at all, of what's going on in the brain. So PET is well suited physicochemically as a direct measurement, and it can and has been used to facilitate therapeutic drug development, which is the real goal of this research.
What are some of the limitations of the clinical use of PET?
Two limitations are it's expensive and it's technically complex. By expensive, a typical cancer scan, FDG glucose scan, might in the United States cost about $5,000. In comparison, although it's highly variable depending upon the type of MRI, the MRI might be $1,000 to $2,000. So both PET and MRI are expensive, but PET also has a technical complexity to it, where you have to make a radioactively labeled drug, which has a very short half-life, prepare it for injection into human subjects, and then do the imaging. So those are significant barriers, but they can and have been overcome. So FDG, this glucose scan, PET scan, is commonly used in cancer to localize the primary tumor and any metastases that can be done. That FDG PET cancer scan might cost, you know, I'd say about $5,000. So even though it's expensive and even though it is technically complex to make this radioactively labeled glucose, it is used. And it's used because it provides clinical utility. So expensive and technical, yes, but those can be overcome if the major hurdle for PET, like other diagnostic tests, is to prove its clinical utility. And in that case, to significantly improve the course of illness. So what we need to do in PET imaging of neuroinflammation or in other areas of PET imaging, the most significant barrier is the surgery that's really going to improve the course of illness. It's not just a measurement that's accurate and interesting. We can measure the amount of amyloid in the brain, and there are PET probes to measure the amount of this protein in the brain. But why bother doing that unless it's connected to some effective therapy that will change the course of illness?
What does the future hold for PET in neurology and psychiatry? Well, I guess, what are you hoping to see over the next few years?
For these various targets, there are multiple different targets that can be imaged. If you have an interest or there's going to be a utility of knowing protein X in the brain, a radioligand very likely could be developed and we could measure it. So it will then be what's the jargon term, is a biomarker. It is a marker of the disease, and there are various types of biomarkers. It's a biomarker to show the presence of the disease. It's a biomarker to show the severity of the disease or the progression of the disease. So PET can be used as a biomarker, for example, to select subjects for targeted treatment. A good example of that comes in the neurology field, where there have been for years now evaluations of anti-amyloid therapies. Well, it only makes sense to go ahead and try an anti-amyloid therapy if that individual has elevated amyloid. And not all patients who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease actually have amyloid. So this is similar to in the periphery. If you want to treat someone for high cholesterol, you just don't base it on whether the person is overweight. You measure the amount of cholesterol and you institute a treatment based upon how much is there. And then you monitor the cholesterol to make sure that it went down with that treatment. So one of them, the big uses, and cancer is way ahead of neurology and psychiatry for that field, is a biomarker to select the subjects for targeted treatment, those who will most respond. So if you have a particular type of receptor on the breast cancer, you get this treatment. If you don't have that, then you'll get another treatment. This comes under the jargon term now of precision medicine. So it's only going to be a subset that will respond to a particular medicine. So my hope is that as more targets are developed, including those for neuroinflammation, they can be used as a biomarker to select people for targeted treatments.
Professor Robert Innes, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, you're welcome.